Florence Williams, who is most recently the author of Breasts, a subject that for some inexplicable reason I seem to be interested in, and a lot of people are interested in. Florence, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on here. So to start off with the crass with that introduction and get back into something a little bit more noble, namely the fact that breasts are, in fact, lactating organs, as you point out very prominently in this book, I wanted to actually get into the history of breastfeeding. Before the 20th century, of course, breastfeeding was the main method of feeding babies. Then we have post-war life ushering in formula and so forth. It has been pointed out, as you say in the book, by evolutionary biologists that 6,000 human genes relating to lactation are among our most stubbornly conserved ones. And if natural selection, as even Darwin has pointed out, that is in favor of lactation, my question to you is, why is artificial selection through industry so very much against it? Just to get things started here.
Oh, that's a big question. Well, you know, there have always been women throughout history, even in our deep evolutionary past, who didn't want to breastfeed or who couldn't breastfeed. Of course, many women died in childbirth.
Yeah.
You know, there were lots of breast infections as well as other infections related to childbirth. And so sometimes women couldn't produce enough milk. And so as I point out in the book, actually wet nursing is one of the oldest professions
Absolutely.
Known to humankind. Humans are very flexible and picky in their feeding habits. And some populations wouldn't wean their infants for years, 3-4 years. You know, the recent cover of Time magazine was so shocking because it had a 3-year-old on the cover.
Yeah.
But in fact, the human race would not be here if it weren't for toddlers breastfeeding in our deep evolutionary past. And then there have always been populations that weaned their young earlier. So when formula came along, many, many women thought this was a great liberating phenomenon and invention. They went for it to with greater and lesser success, I would say. You know, in the 19th century, women sometimes tried to raise their infants on sort of oatmeal, basically, and cow's milk.
That was sort of the formula of its time.
That was the formula of its time. It was often a total disaster. Very high.
I would imagine oatmeal wouldn't be exactly quite the same sort of constituency.
It's not really everything you need.
Yeah.
And so infant mortality was really high among infants who were not breastfed. Fortunately, now formula, you know, is pretty good at approximating the nutritional needs of the infant. But as we're learning more and more all the time, breast milk isn't just a food.
Yeah.
It's actually a medicine.
It's a way of life.
It's a way of life.
Sorry. it is actually a way of life. I mean, you know, in all seriousness, and as you point out in this book, there's also a good deal of adulterated breast milk that is running around right now. We'll get into the whole phthalates and plastic chemicals in just a bit, but I'm wondering, you know, why aren't we really sort of considering this? I guess your book is a starting point, or is this, in fact, one of the serious issues that scientists are presently looking into, or is it?
Oh, yes, it is. Breast milk now has been known to have contaminants in it from the industrial world. I tested my breast milk when I was breastfeeding my second child, and I found out I had flame retardants and jet fuel ingredient, trace amounts of pesticides.
That's what you get for having a pilot career. Oh, you didn't have a pilot career.
I didn't have a pilot career.
Okay, well, wow.
We all have these substances coursing through our bodies.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, some of them really collect in fatty tissue in the breast, and then the breast is really masterful at converting these substances into food.
Yes.
So it ends up in our breast milk. But I would point out that I did continue breastfeeding.
Yeah.
I was convinced that the benefits still outweighed the risks. And of course, formula is not a completely pure product either. It's also contaminated with heavy metals and pesticides and you know, whatever else is in the water that you're mixing it with. And then, you know, of course, there are sometimes these scares that come out of China where you find melamine and other weird additives in formula. So unfortunately, I feel like we've taken this miraculous evolutionary substance and we've sort of degraded it to the point where you can really now almost compare it to formula.
Yeah. So we can, in fact, compare sullied breast milk of the present industrial age with the formula of yesteryear that infants relied upon. Is it safe to say that we can determine which is the greater threat these days, or what?
I still think the benefits of breast milk are incredibly profound and amazing. You know, we're just learning more and more all the time about how breast milk boosts the immune system. And there's some evidence that despite all the pollutants in breast milk, it still protects the infant possibly from the effects of other chemicals.
Yeah.
You know, it boosts the IQ and it helps teach the human immune system what's a good pathogen, what's a bad pathogen. So there are all kinds of great reasons to still use it. Of course, unfortunately, in the United States anyway, we don't really support breastfeeding.
Yeah.
You know, as you can tell from the reaction to that Time magazine cover, we're still deeply uncomfortable with it.
There are still public laws, however, that permit women to breastfeed their children. We've seen more and more of in the last, like, say, decade or two. I think there's, especially, well, we're in New York City, so we can kind of be a little hubristic about this. You're coming from Colorado, so I think it's a little more challenging there.
Well, there are always these stories in the news of women who, you know, sort of kicked out of the shopping mall because they need to breastfeed their infant.
Yeah.
And that always, you know, sometimes that creates this big reaction, and sometimes lactating moms will come have protests.
Lactating moms with pitchforks. I love it.
Yeah, stay away from them. They're dangerous.
So breast milk, you would say, is robust enough to contend with these phthalates and the various industrial chemicals and so forth? I mean, do we really know?
Yeah, we don't really know.
We don't really know.
Right.
Do we have any clue?
Well, it's really hard to study the effects of these chemicals in humans, but there have been some interesting and, I think, disconcerting studies with lab animals.
Yeah.
And we know that, for example, the flame retardants that were found in my breast milk are known to interact with the thyroid receptor. And the thyroid is a really critical, it's a critical organ for especially neurodevelopment.
Yeah, I would say so.
We all need our thyroids. It has to do with neurodevelopment. It has to do with regulating our metabolism, regulating temperature. So these chemicals are known to kind of mess up our hormonal, you know, or interact, I guess, with our hormonal systems. And so it is disconcerting. Fortunately, they still exist in our bodies in pretty low levels.
Yeah.
But I have to ask myself, first of all, why aren't these chemicals tested for human health effects? Because shockingly, they're not. And the other question is, why do we have to even use them in the first place? Some of them, for example, the flame retardants, we all have California to thank for this. There's a California statute requiring that, for example, upholstered furniture in our homes be really liberally doused with this stuff. And yet there's no evidence that the flame retardants save lives. The idea is that they buy us a few more minutes or a few more seconds, really. It's a 12-second ignition rule. But in fact, that doesn't seem to happen. And when you put these chemicals in your couch and then your couch burns in a house fire, it will burn smokier and it will burn more toxic.
Yeah.
And so that's smoke is really often what kills people.
Since we're really talking about plastic chemicals quite a bit, and a good chunk of your book, as a matter of fact, deals with plastic chemicals, I have to ask how you ended up following this particular trajectory. I mean, certainly the book did not start off this way, as the opening chapters reveal, and I'm hoping to vary the conversation a little bit, but I'm wondering how this became almost more a book about the impact of our industrial age upon our bodies, as opposed to, I suppose, you know, just breasts in our culture. I mean, you know, is there really also anything we can do about it? I mean, you know, you and I think are pretty helpless when we come to the sort of people on the Beltway who really couldn't care less about these things, or at least right now can't care less. And it looks like there are no immediate signs that they actually will care about this issue. So what of this? Why did the chemical angle come about, and what can we really do about it aside from kind of pull out our hair, or in my case, pull out my skin, you know?
That's a great question. I wanted to write a book about the science of the breast, and I wanted to write about how modern life was changing breasts. And so it actually became very quickly apparent that this was going to be an environmental history of a body part, because our breasts have changed so much in modern life, not just because of chemicals, although that's a big part, but also because of our diets and our the way women now have children so much later.
Yes.
Sometimes don't have children at all. We've changed our reproductive histories in a way that, that also dramatically changes our breasts. And we also know that breasts are really responsive to pharmaceuticals. And for example, the birth control pill immediately changes a woman's breast. Hormone replacement therapy that she takes in menopause. So almost at every phase of the life cycle of the breast, you know, you can see this impact of modern life. And so that's really what the book became.
Yeah. Well, to say nothing also of breast cancer rates, which we've seen more of it going on. And we also, as we saw earlier in the year with the Komen for the Cure controversy, they pulled funding from Planned Parenthood and therefore prevented Planned Parenthood from allowing women to go ahead and have their breasts examined and actually treat a lot of early signs of cancer and so forth. So the question is well, if so many forces are working against the discovery of exactly how many women right now have breast cancer, I mean, you know, what does all this talk about it do? I mean, how can we raise awareness? Do you have any ideas on this?
I think there's actually pretty good awareness of breast cancer, and you know, Komen has its problems, but to their credit, you know, I think that now women can talk about breast cancer.
Yeah.
And women
well,
and their
too,
family members. And exactly.
That's why I'm talking with you, right?
Exactly. I think the breast has been so objectified sexually. But in the last 20, 30 years, because of groups like Komen and so many other public health groups, we now are at the point where I think there is really good awareness about breast cancer. There's great awareness about screening for breast cancer. But I think a lot of women are still frustrated that we don't pay more attention to the idea of prevention.
Yeah.
There's so much we don't know about the causes of breast cancer, so little we know about it. If you're serious about preventing breast cancer, you really have to look into that.
Yeah.
And we all the known risk factors for breast cancer, things like family history, the age at which you have your first child, obesity, smoking, these risk factors only seem to account for about half of all breast cancers. So the big question mark is, well, what else is going on? What's causing the other half? And we do know that breast cancer rates are rising globally. Especially in rapidly industrializing nations. Part of that is because there's better detection.
Yeah.
Part of it is because women are living longer. So those are good things. But we know, for example, in China, that women there get breast cancer on average 10 years earlier than women get it here. And so, you know, scientists are looking more and more at the epidemiology of this. What's the relationship between some of these lesser known factors, such as radiation, and also chemicals.
Sure. Zena Werb, a cellular biologist who you visited in San Francisco, well, she showed you molecular footage of the milk ducts that develop during puberty. You write that these images were a little too abstract for you, and you confronted the rather extraordinary truth that, well, most of our understanding of breast anatomy actually comes from a little under two centuries ago, back in the days when it was easier to collect the organs of dead people. In fact, there's, of course, the infamous Burke and Hare. I mean, they had a steady trade in murdering the poor and selling off the organs anatomists. It's actually a good, it's not a good John Landis movie, but it's an interesting John Landis movie about
this. I'll
have
to look at that.
Yeah.
That's good.
My understanding is that the Anatomy Act of 1832, which put a stop to the Burkers, this was repealed by the Human Tissue Act of 2004, and that the Human Tissue Authority, at least in the UK, well, they are the one who regulates corpses in the UK. Now, here's my question to you. If biologists like Webb are basically they're concentrating on rats, as we were sort of alluding to earlier, basically, my question is, you know, are there loopholes that prevent present-day anatomists from studying the breasts? I mean, how are we making greater strides at the cellular level? Is that how we uncover the intricacies of the breast these days, more from a cellular level than, say, an anatomical level, more looking at rats rather than humans? What about this?
Yeah, this isn't just relevant to breasts, but so much of science these days is focused on molecules and genetics. And I think now there's a realization that we maybe put too much stake in genetics and that DNA isn't really going to map out for us our destinies, because there is this interplay of DNA with the environment, and our DNA is kind of built to bend according to environmental influences. So some scientists are saying, well, we really need to go back to the organ itself, and we need to understand more how it works. Dr. Susan Love, who's a very well-known breast cancer surgeon and advocate, has started a foundation, and one of the things she's trying to do is provide funding for scientists to go back and actually map the milk ducts. We really don't even know how many milk ducts there are in a breast. We don't know how many...
We don't know by now.
We don't even know. We don't really know where cancer starts. We think it starts in the little milk.
There's no Google Maps for the milk ducts.
No, and that's what we need.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting.
I want an app to actually examine the milk ducts.
I know. I'm sure there is one. There are lots of other breast-related apps out there. Someone told me that there's an app where you can just download an image of 1,200 breasts.
Wow.
And his 12-year-old was looking at it.
And it's not pornographic.
Oh, well.
And his 12-year-old was looking at it. No, but this is fascinating to me. I mean, why have we been so reluctant to map the milk ducts? I mean, you would think that here is this fascinating organ. You would think by now we would have devoted more resources to it.
You would think. What I heard is that we actually know far more about the cow dairy industry than we know about human milk ducts and human milk glands. And this makes sense if you think about it, because there's a lot of money to be made in the dairy industry.
Yeah.
Another scientist told me we know so much more about red wine because that research is incredibly well funded. Yeah. And we know that, for example, red wine helps with cholesterol. But this researcher told me he's really frustrated by this, and he's like, enough already with the red wine. The red wine is overblown. You know, really.
Overblown?
It's overblown. I mean, sure, if you like a glass of wine, have one.
Like a glass
but don't
of
think
wine.
It's going to save your life. If you really want to investigate a food to learn how it helps human health, there's only one food on the planet that was designed to be eaten by humans.
Yes.
And that was designed to help humans, and that's human milk.
Yes. Well, certainly. But regrettably, the demographic for human milk is a little on the low side. Unless, of course, we have marketing people start targeting those babies and actually run an ad. Except the problem with that is, well, breast milk, well, it can actually be industrialized, as you find out in the book to some degree. But on the other hand, you know, I suppose what we're really advocating for is perhaps a human cheese market or something. I mean, you know, is science really so paralyzed by business interests these days? Is this what's preventing us from really fully understanding the human breast?
Well, ironically, there are some companies out there who think they can make money from human milk.
Uh-huh.
And biotech and big pharma companies are looking really hard at human milk now because we're learning more and more about how these components really help the immune system. For example, even the Gates Foundation is funding some basic research in this area too, because they believe that if you can package, if you can sort of synthesize and package some of these components of human milk, you can actually save millions of lives potentially in the developing world, where infants don't have access to clean water, and even if they are partly breastfed, the other contaminants in foods are introduced a little bit too early, and the children get very, very sick, toddlers and infants alike. And so some companies in the U.S. also want to market human breast milk products for adults, for example, who have immune-compromised systems. If they have cancer patients, for example, you know, whose systems get really nuked by cancer treatment, can be greatly benefited by, you know, human breast milk has probiotics in it. So these are bacteria actually that exist in breast milk that are beneficial to us. And human breast milk also has prebiotics. And these are the sugars and carbohydrates that the good bacteria come in and eat. And we know that breast milk actually helps recruit this wonderful colony of bacteria that would help not only infants but even adults. And there are some places now in the world where you can actually get human breast milk sort of on the black market and use it as use it as treatment for eye infections.
Yeah, wow.
And even I will say too, in this country there is even a black market for breast milk.
Really, what is the black market like in this country?
It's totally unregulated.
Yeah,
there are mothers who want to buy it for their infants, maybe because their kids are adopted or because they can't breastfeed. It's also some adults are buying it who have like irritable bowel syndrome or Crohn's disease.
Who need to have pure human milk, and that quote pure human milk, yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because there's a lot of attention being paid now to raw milk, you know, raw dairy milk. There's an article in the New Yorker this week about the great health benefits of cow's milk. And it was interesting to me that no one actually mentioned that human milk is even far more beneficial to us because we're humans.
Take that, vegans.
And then, you know, sometimes the dairy industry gets all bent out of shape because they get annoyed that soy milk, for example, and almond milk, that these products are marketed as milk, and the cow people say, "Oh, we are the real milk because we're
cow milk."
We are
the real milk.
And I say, "Excuse me, actually, yeah. You're not the real milk. You know, Mom right here has the real milk."
So, really, it seems to me that you might be advocating for us to go into any common bodega and have cow milk right next to human milk. Pick up a gallon right there. You think that might actually solve the problem? You think if we actually drank our own milk, even beyond the age of three, that
I think it's more likely that we'll see some of these substances replicated and synthesized and packaged in a way that benefits adults.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll be really buying human milk anytime soon unless we somehow can recruit a factory of women, which is kind of a grim thought.
Wow, this is pretty morbid. I love it. Speaking of morbidity, let's talk about the fact that 289,000 women went under the knife to enlarge their breasts in 2009. You visited a guy named Dr. Michael Ciaravino, is that right?
Caravino.
Michael Caravino, in the name of journalism, to get the showroom treatment, so to speak, which involved disrobing and seeing a graphic rendering of how your own breasts might be augmented through this man's quite interesting industrial methods. Dr. C, as he likes to be called, told you that big breasts are part of a Texas tradition. So what do you think ultimately accounts for why women want to get their breasts enlarged? I mean, is it the marketing of confidence, of empowerment? Why is this, no pun intended, a high growth industry?
It is a growth industry.
Yeah.
Breast implants are more popular now than ever before.
Yeah.
It's kind of a conundrum to me. You know, it's a mystery to me why so many women want them. But of course, we live in a culture that really celebrates big breasts.
Yeah.
And in fact, when you do studies, it's sort of a myth that all men like big breasts. I know a lot do, but there are also a lot of men out there who like small breasts and like medium breasts, and some men out there who don't like breasts at all, as hard as it might be to believe. So I think that women think that men like them. And women will say, if you ask a woman, well, why are you getting implants? She'll say, oh, I'm doing this for me. It's not for my boyfriend. It's not for my husband. It's going to boost my self-confidence and my self-esteem. And I can't really argue with that. You know, I think it does have that effect on women. But I also think we need to look at the context in which these decisions are made. And I think there's more pressure than ever on women, despite the women's movement, despite gains in the workplace, more pressure than ever to look a certain way. And now, thanks to the internet, and I mentioned that app, for breasts, where you can download 1,200 breasts that 12-year-olds are looking at. You know, both boys and girls are growing up looking at these images, thousands of them, and most of them are fake. They're either Photoshopped. There's a liquify tool in Photoshop that's very, very popular. Or they're surgically enhanced breasts. And so it's this all sort of impossible standard that young women have to compete with. And it's kind of really, frankly, it's a pornographic standard. It's not, you know, the double D breast is just not that often found in nature. So, you know, unfortunately, I think for parents, you know, we have more challenges than ever to raise our girls, you know, to recognize that these images aren't real and to kind of feel good about their own bodies. So how do you do that? You know, I think...
Well, if augmented breasts that are clearly artificial hold some appeal for a male population that is regrettably patriarchal in some sense, I mean, you know, what do you tell a young girl who has smaller breasts, natural breasts, perfectly reasonable breasts, I mean, you know, I'm sure, you know, what do you tell her to combat these increasing demands? I mean, you know, pornography just keeps getting ratcheted up. It's been remarked upon by many that women have to compete against the presentations that porn sometimes does, or
right.
And so, you know, so what is a way to combat that if it's such an omnipresent force in our culture?
Well, I think parents of girls and educators have long struggled with this because there's so much emphasis on the appearance of girls overall. So I think it's important to help them find other avenues, you know, to self-esteem, like academic achievement, you know, public service, athleticism. I mean, there just are so many other ways that you can kind of boost the self-esteem of a girl. And I think it's really important to do that. I also think that we need to help girls just celebrate their natural bodies. And of course, small breasts, you know, they've been kind of pathologized in some ways by the plastic surgery industry. But in fact, they're spectacularly successful at nursing and breastfeeding and functioning. And that's why there are still so many small breasts in the population. You know, it's obviously it's been a successful trait. So I think if we can, you know, help girls celebrate their bodies. And I think athleticism and girls sports and, you know, is a great way to help do that. And also we need to keep our girls healthy with healthy diets. And hopefully that will also, you know, if girls are thinner, they're less likely to enter puberty earlier and to get breasts earlier. And we know that girls who get breasts earlier are at also higher risk for breast cancer, things like that. So as parents, I think the diet becomes a really important factor here, too.
Sure. I wanted to get back to the issue of breast enlargement. Timmy Jean Lindsay underwent the world's first silicone breast implant. She told the Daily Mail that while women should be free to choose whether they want implants or not, there have been times when she has wanted them taken out. Yet when you talked with her, she said that she wasn't sure. So, you know, she didn't want to go through the surgical experience again. How many women with breast implants did you talk with for this book? And is it safe to say that most of them vacillate on this question like Timmy Jean? I mean, you use the phrase also, living museum, which is kind of reflective of the problem we're talking about. If we refer to someone with physically enlarged breasts as a living museum, we almost objectify them in the name of science as opposed to masculine desire. So what of this? I mean, you know, how many women did you talk with? What do they typically go through? You know, do they want to go back? And what did Timmy Jean tell you?
Well, Timmy Jean had her silicone implants put in 1962, 50 years ago. Those early generation of silicone implants were terrible. I mean, they used to leak open. This sort of silicone gel would ooze out all over the body. Women would get infections. They'd get lumps. You know, the implants would harden. And so these women who were unhappy with these results joined what became the largest class action lawsuit in the history of the United States against the manufacturers of implants. And in fact, the implants were banned in this country for 14 years following those lawsuits by the FDA. The FDA has done a lot of studies. Other people have done studies. And there's actually never been a proven link between disease and breast cancer and the implants. But we do know the implants have a lot of other side effects. They've gotten a lot better, but they still have a lot of problems. They still get hard. They have a shelf life of about 10 years.
There's less of a nipple sensation and so forth.
Some women actually lose nipple sensation, which is not something you hear about. It's really underreported. They also have problems lactating. And yet, when you survey women with implants and you say, would you do it again? Overwhelmingly, they say they would do it again. So that was a shock to me.
Yeah.
Most of them are thrilled with their implants.
Yeah. On the other hand, as you pointed out here, the FDA has said, well, if there's no link, that if you have implants or you have natural breasts, it's pretty much the same risk. And so the question is, well, should we really be concerned? I mean, yes, you're right. It is very unusual for us to cram some foreign substance into a body, especially a woman's body, especially her most sensitive organ. On the other hand, if right now there isn't any research saying this is harmful, well, if people want to do it, shouldn't they be allowed to do it? That's what the industrialists will tell you. What's your response to that?
Oh, sure. I'm all for choice. But I think that right now a lot of women don't get all the information. And for example, I went to talk to this plastic surgery office. I went to a plastic surgery office in Houston. And the woman who sort of started me out on my consultation there said, let me just tell you that these are the most studied devices in history and that they're 100% safe. And that's just not true. They're not 100% safe. Breast implants are marketed as almost like a product, you know, like a face cream. They're sort of a consumer product. They're not marketed as a major medical surgical procedure, which is what they are. And women who have these procedures face all the risks that women get in surgeries, bruising, pain, infection. They still rupture sometimes. They still get hard. the nerves get severed. You know, these are things that just, I don't think women are fully informed of.
But that's the actual implants themselves. I mean, how do these actually affect the breasts in terms of rise of cancer and things like that? I mean, if there is no disease-related uptake or major distinction between what you get with natural and what you get with artificial, I mean, you know, the industrialists will again say, well, they went ahead and they put it in their body, they accepted it, and while, you know, our implants didn't exactly have the lifespan of, you know, more than 20 years, or they ended up breaking down, well, they kind of knew they were getting something artificial, so, you know, they signed the deal. So this is the issue here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a valid question, and I think that these implants are, you know, relatively safe overall if you're willing to live with those other side effects. And some of those side effects are pretty grim. But nevertheless, some women are willing to take on those risks, and they find those risks worthwhile.
Yeah.
So I don't think, you know, I can really judge them. I think as long as they're really informed, more power to them.
So then, with that in mind, and in light of the many pages that you devote to phthalates and industrial chemicals, I mean, how concerned should we be about the fact that our couch is, your couch especially, or your home office is just riddled with all sorts of toxic dust? I mean, you know, don't we need a little toxicity in our lives? I mean, or should we in fact be concerned? I mean, that's the interesting question that I came away from your book. I mean, on one hand, yes, this is terrible, but going back to what I phrased at the beginning, what can we do about it? I mean, right. Unless, of course, you go to the jungle and you don't have electricity and you don't have radiation and you don't have a phone and you live in comparative purity, but that's not exactly an option for any person living in a country such as ours.
I don't think it's an all or nothing scenario. I don't think either we live with toxic dust or we go live in the jungle. And in fact, if we look to Europe, there's a great model there for a really common sense approach to testing chemicals.
Yeah.
In Europe, you can't put a chemical on the market unless you prove it's safe. In the United States, we have almost the opposite standard.
Yes.
You can't remove a chemical from the marketplace unless it's proven harmful. It's so hard to do. That's such a high bar. We don't provide funding for scientists to do it.
And they're often several decades late when they do find out it's harmful.
Yeah, I mean, only a very small handful of chemicals has ever been banned in this country. And in fact, 177 countries have now signed something called the Stockholm Protocol, which is to severely restrict the use of chemicals we know to be toxic, we know to be persistent, and that we know to be accumulating in mammalian tissues. 177 countries have signed this, including all the major industrial countries. I'm actually not sure about China, but the United States has not signed this Stockholm Protocol. So I think, you know, here we have this unusual sort of free reign by industry, and in fact there are disincentives to test chemicals for human health effects. And this makes me mad. It makes me concerned.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's a good model there in how many parts of the world are doing it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that note of where does the future lie in chemicals and where does the future lie in breasts? Florence, it was a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I could tell that was my milk cow by the way that she looked. So if you see my milk cow, I'd please her no. Lord, I ain't had no milk and butter since my cow's been gone. Tried everything, baby. Get along with you. Now I'm gonna tell you.